Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program manager here with GTI.
And I'm Catherine Wagner, an intern at GTI.
And today we're really thrilled to be joined by Virlin Owens, who's a senior research fellow and head of the Navigating the Indo-Pacific program at the Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI. At RUSI, she focuses on a really wide range of topics related to the Indo-Pacific and Asia-Pacific region, including issues related to Chinese foreign and domestic policy, cross-strait relations, and maritime security. Her commentaries and opinions have been featured in publications and events around the world, and she's also the host of RUSI's fantastic Bridging the Oceans podcast, which I really encourage everyone who's interested in the Indo-Pacific and security, anything related to this, to check out. Virla, really, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, we're really excited to have you here. What is a really interesting time for the UK, both domestically and for its foreign policy around the world. There's been a lot of change recently, and we're really excited to have you here to really provide some context and really shed some light on what are the important factors here. So just to kick things off, for people around the world that aren't as familiar with the UK's foreign policy, particularly in recent years, you know, how does the UK fit into the broader Indo-Pacific conversation? How has London traditionally approached the region, particularly China and Taiwan?
So we've seen an evolution, really, I would say, of UK policy. Of course, in the Integrated Review of Foreign Policy, Defense and Development Policy, which the government released last year in March 2021, we saw what they termed an Indo-Pacific tilt, which was a bit of a framework around how the UK was going to engage in what we know today to be the Indo-Pacific region. And there was some feeling that this was, you know, because of Brexit, that the UK now had to do this and was kind of jumping on that bandwagon. I think that's actually not quite true. If you look at UK policy towards the region, be that kind of Indian Ocean region or Asia Pacific, more focused on the Pacific region, that has been growing over time. The UK has always understood the kind of economic linkages in this part of the world and the growing markets, but it's also had that traditional, I guess, historical engagement as well, where it still has ties through the Commonwealth. It still has ties through the Five Power Defense Arrangement, FPDA. It has, of course, you know, key partners like Japan, like Australia, New Zealand. And so those ties have been growing over time. What you have seen is, I think, a greater understanding of the securitization, some of these linkages, you know, the kind of elements of defense and security and why that matters to the UK. And so if you look at, I think, the Indo-Pacific tilt now, there's kind of three main components to it. One, economic, as I said, so furthering those FTAs. And there is some truth to the fact that Brexit means that the UK has to engage with other markets around the world more intensely. And a lot of those market opportunities are, of course, in the Indo-Pacific region. So that's one. The other is security, you know, understanding that with 60% of global trade flowing through the Indo-Pacific, the stability of the Indo-Pacific is pretty important, not just the stability of close partners and friends in the region. And so, you know, what can the UK do in that respect to help? And then finally, there's the values piece in terms of the integrated review's tilt towards the Indo-Pacific in how the country's going to engage with the region. And here, you know, the integrated review talks a lot about open societies. This brings in, you know, questions around science and technology as well, standard setting, but also more generally upholding the rules-based international order. So all of these elements are interlinked in how the UK hopes to, engage in this part of the world. But I think there's one kind of underlying theme as well. And you see that, of course, in both the integrated review and also the accompanying Defense Command paper, which is that there is a concern around Chinese behavior. So there's a concern around how China's military professionalization and modernization efforts and its capabilities as a result of that are being used in the region, you know, Chinese norms and standards, which are not necessarily commensurate with those that the UK or more generally, I suppose, the West holds dear, how that changes the strategic landscape as well. So all of these kind of push and pull factors have really, I think, come to the fore over the last few years.
Obviously, the last few years have been fairly tumultuous for the country, with Brexit, COVID, and several leadership changes kind of throwing things into flux. In your opinion, how have these changes factored into the UK's policy towards the Indo-Pacific? Specifically, have they influenced London's approach to the Taiwan Strait?
I think your point on COVID is actually a really important one, because we do see a significant shift in how China is perceived after COVID, or at least during COVID and since then. And then also the same, I think, can be said for Taiwan. So COVID, of course, exposed a lot of questions around what is national security, what is national resilience. And those discussions were had here too. So things around supply chain security, for example, not just around PPE or specific medicine, but then also resulting questions around, say, semiconductor chips and the industry more generally there. There's questions, of course, around China specifically in transparency around COVID and whether the lack of transparency was problematic. There were questions, of course, around, you know, how China conducted itself diplomatically. And at that time, we saw an increase in what was called then at the time, Wolf Warrior diplomacy. So this very assertive, very combative style of engagement of foreign policy. You know, none of that really, I think, played very well. And if we look at, I think Pew has done some interesting public opinion studies where the UK's change in perception of China is really quite extraordinary. You know, if we look at, say, previous years, as far back, I don't know, if we want to pick a date, 2010, for example, you know, 35% of respondents saw China as unfavorable. If we fast track that to 2020, that grew suddenly to 74%. And now in 2022, we're looking at 69%. So the UK is in one of the top countries in Europe in terms of having a negative perception of China. And I don't think that that's going to go away. So building on the experience of COVID and the spotlight that kind of shone on China, there were already questions around Huawei and technology. There were questions around, of course, Hong Kong, for which the UK has, of course, historical relationship, and more generally, Xinjiang as well as a key area of concern. And then the way that I think this then manifests itself in terms of an Indo-Pacific approach is that you see the UK not necessarily saying we're not going to work with China ever on anything, but it's I think evolved in this piece of, you know, who are the partners with whom we share a common vision for the international order, for the world, with whom do we share close principles and values, and how can we work together better to ensure that, you know, those resilience pieces, for example, are enhanced? How can we ensure that we approach international security, be that, you know, particularly in the Indo-Pacific region, are there ways that you can burden share better, particularly now when we look at the state, of course, of the global economy and the fact that resources more generally are limited?
Great. Well, I'm glad you brought up the UK's sort of perception of China. It's really been interesting to watch the UK from afar, going from what has, you know, kind of been described by some as a golden era of Sino-British relations throughout a lot of the 2010s to, like you said, since 2020 and a little bit before, this massive rhetorical shift with the ban on Huawei, with the much more stronger criticism of human rights abuses in Hong Kong and Xinjiang. So you've already talked about what's been behind this shift. Be interested to hear, you know, what we're always interested in looking at countries that have started to turn against China's, whether it's Wolf Warrior diplomacy, behavior during the pandemic, is, you know, how enduring is this shift? Is this primarily just a kind of rhetorical response to recent events, or is it a meaningful policy shift that'll have enduring consequences?
So I think it hasn't been a sudden, you know, a sudden out of the blue, I think, change. I think over the successive governments that we've seen in place following Cameron, who, of course, you know, during that time championed the so-called golden era of economic relations with China around kind of 2015. Since then, we've had Prime Minister May, we've had Boris Johnson. And I think in every single one of these governments, you've seen a gradual kind of growing skepticism, or what they, you know, what's often termed as a clear-eyed approach to China. So understanding that actually there are some pretty significant challenges in that bilateral relationship, and that there needs to be more of a clear-eyed approach to how you overcome those, and also understanding where those challenges are likely to remain no matter what, but where you could possibly cooperate if both sides were willing. So I don't think that this is something that will be rolled back, quite frankly. This is, you know, a next step, I think, in the evolution of the general trajectory, not just in the UK, but I think you see that more broadly in Europe as well. I think the same can be said for Taiwan. You know, Taiwan has really been put under a spotlight, particularly with COVID, in terms of how interconnected Taiwan is in the international economy, how important it is as well to include Taiwan in terms in things like global health, you know, for which they're prevented from being observers, for example, of the WHO. Those issues, I think, you know, I think Europe and the UK specifically are kind of coming to terms with respect to Taiwan and understanding that Taiwan does play a vital role in so many of these transnational issues that we all have to manage. But the question is, you know, what does that then specifically mean for policy? And I don't think we're going to see a radical shift here in terms of potentially the matching the type of engagement that the United States has. I think Europe is still, and the UK as well, are still trying to figure out where that balance lies. But for now, I think, you know, we're looking at stronger economic ties and trade ties. There's a huge interest in the UK here to see how the UK can work with Taiwan on the net zero challenge, working on future energy solutions. There's an interest here in the UK that matches Taiwan's energy mix plan very well, which is investing in offshore wind technology. So those kinds of issues and areas, I think, are, you know, there's a lot to be done there. And, you know, the trade and investment talks more generally with Taiwan are continuing. I think there's also areas of education where both sides, you know, stand to benefit from greater investment. So that's kind of where I think that's going. On the other kind of more strategic side of that, you know, it's interesting to mention that, of course, in last year, in 2021, the US and the UK reportedly held high-level talks on Taiwan, specifically on how to reduce the chance of war, but then also secondly on conflict contingencies and what they might look like. And that's really interesting. And I think that is a new development, at least if we look at open sources. So, you know, there is at least some strategic thinking on what the UK could do. But these are all, you know, highly sensitive conversations that happen behind closed doors, for which there's very little indication or public information. But the fact that it's been reported that they've held these meetings is really interesting. And I think it goes to show that the UK government, and more generally, I think there's an understanding in Europe as well, that, you know, stability across the Taiwan Strait is incredibly important. And we see that reflected at least in, you know, statements, for example, by the G7 as well.
It's nice to hear you expand on the different ways that the UK and other EU countries are kind of looking to expand their relationship with Taiwan in terms of things like trade, inclusion in international medical organizations. You mentioned that the US and the UK kind of engaged in closed-door talks last year about the importance of maintaining stability in the Taiwan Strait. And historically, the UK has been fairly quiet when it comes to Taiwan and its defense. However, things do seem to have changed with Prime Minister Liz Truss stating in September that the UK would, quote-unquote, work with allies to make sure Taiwan is able to defend itself. Can you expand on the character of these statements and what the implications are, maybe how invested the UK is in contributing to the defense of Taiwan?
Yeah, that statement, which has been repeated, I think, was repeated a few times by Prime Minister Truss. I think it's interesting. It drew a lot of attention, absolutely. But my question is, of course, you know, what does that actually mean? So right after she said it, of course, in the context of Ukraine, learning lessons from Ukraine, that Ukraine should have been better equipped to defend itself from the get-go. And that we should learn lessons for Taiwan in that respect as well. And she I think backtracked that quite quickly, where she said, oh, well, it's, you know, it's something for all of us to think about, not just the UK. So I wonder to what extent this really reflects, say, a change in policy where, you know, the conclusion was automatically drawn in the media that the UK would help, I don't know, consider sending arms to Taiwan to help defend itself. I don't think that that is what that meant. And I think walking that statement back so that it wasn't misinterpreted was I think, an indication of that. In terms of defending Taiwan, though, or helping Taiwan defend itself, which is, I think, more the case, again, it's very unclear what significant shift this actually would imply. I think there's more generally a need for, I guess, discussion amongst allies about what that looks like. But at the moment, I think it's very much kind of continuing the same. So, you know, advocating for Taiwan to remain included, or to be included, I should say, at the international stage, to sit at the table, even just as an observer, to be able to participate or listen in. It's about ensuring and signaling, I think, that Chinese aggression is of serious concern, not just to countries in the region, but to European countries and to the UK as well. But if we think about, you know, militarily, what does that mean? Does that mean that the UK is going to send ships or aircraft to a Taiwan contingency? I mean, there's no public indication. There's no information on this. I think at the moment as well, it would be very difficult to imagine that, given that, you know, the forces, you know, are not nearby necessarily. So what those contingencies looks like is difficult to imagine. The UK does have resources in other parts of the Indo-Pacific. So in the Gulf, for example, if we think about, you know, what a contingency on Taiwan might look like, well, is there then an opportunity for the UK or other European allies to stabilize, you know, very key sea lines of communication or choke points to ensure that those don't become unstable as a result of a serious crisis in the Taiwan Strait? But really, I think it's part of that diplomatic signaling to China, to Beijing, that particularly as exemplified in the live fire exercises recently that we saw as a response to Nancy Pelosi's visit, that drew huge concern in Europe. And that is not something that European countries consider to be irrelevant for their own national security.
I'm so glad we're having this conversation when we are. Obviously, it's been a fairly tumultuous time in UK politics, particularly October was really one of the most eventful months in UK political history. After just 6 weeks as Prime Minister, Liz Truss has been forced to resign her position. Now, with Rishi Sunak poised to take the reins, UK government is continuing to deal with huge amounts of uncertainty, both at home and abroad. I'd be curious to hear, in from your experience watching the UK government and watching Rishi Sunak and his political positions, do you have a sense of how he will approach China and Taiwan?
So I think we've obviously seen some political turbulence in the UK, just in terms of the leadership changing once more. Under Truss, there was an expectation that the UK government was going to take a harder line on China. So, you know, this included murmurings around whether she was going to officially call what's going on in Xinjiang a genocide. There were discussions around, you know, whether she was going to officially term China a threat, which would really elevate it to the acute challenge that Russia is for the UK at a national security level. So, you know, was she going to match Russia and China in that sense? And then, of course, she said a few times that the UK and others needed to learn the lessons of Ukraine, and that arming countries in advance is incredibly important as a mode of deterrence and preparedness. And that we should learn those lessons for Taiwan. Now, she walked that back quite quickly to say, oh, well, this is not just, you know, this is not a specific case. It's not specifically for the UK to do, but more generally, we should all be thinking about these things. So it's unclear where she would have necessarily landed at the end of the day, but certainly a very tough tone on China was expected. With Sunak, there's a lot of questions about this, of course. Now, when we saw the leadership kind of campaigning, where Truss ultimately came out victorious, during that campaign, you know, Rishi did step up his language on China. He said that China was, I believe, one of the greatest challenges or threats for the UK, for national security. But there was also a feeling that this has come from someone who was the chancellor, who was very financially minded, economically minded, and that potentially he had to step up that tone because of, more generally, as we've discussed, the environment, the skepticism that is growing in the UK about China really necessitated this. He has, of course, advocated for the economic and financial dialogue between the UK and China to be resumed. That has been on hold since, I believe, 2019. So where he, you know, at the end of the day will land now that he's the prime minister is yet to be seen. Will he step it up as significantly as Truss was expected to do? Unclear. I think generally we can continue to expect a tough line on China. You know, the events in Manchester, for example, around a Hong Kong activist being attacked, being physically reprimanded, so to speak, for, as the Chinese embassy and officials have put it, speaking negatively about the Chinese leadership. That is clearly unacceptable behavior, for which there has been, I think, an outcry in Parliament as well. It's really fed into that discussion, that debate in the UK around the nature of the UK-China relationship and some of the challenges that China is presenting to the UK, including domestically. So in the integrated review, I think there has been an expectation that this was going to be updated by Truss. There's a question, of course, whether that will still be the case, but there's been some comments, I think, online to say that this is expected to still continue. If there is an update and when that does get published, if it is, then I think we can expect a continuation of a tough line on China. The question is, of course, whether, if it does happen, whether China will be elevated to an official kind of threat, as Truss was slated to do. And in that respect, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, the UK is in a tough position economically. Following the war in Ukraine, energy prices are soaring. The cost of living is a huge problem. And these kinds of domestic issues are really going to, I think, have to take priority when it comes to Rishi's plans over the next 2 years. So look, the Indo-Pacific, China policy, that all remains important, but it is getting the country back on track over the next 2 years, which, like many other countries, I think those challenges are going to be at the forefront of people's minds and, of course, for leadership as well.
It's been so interesting to follow the linkages that people have drawn between the situation in Ukraine and a potential contingency in the Taiwan Strait. Do you have a sense of to what degree the UK is linking those two situations? How much is Ukraine factoring into London's approach to the Indo-Pacific and fear of some sort of Taiwan Strait contingency?
So I think what Ukraine really did was kind of highlight the kind of interconnectedness between kind of Europe and your Atlantic region and the Indo-Pacific. I think there's one thing that's said is that these two regions are indivisible. And I think this was particularly the case in two ways. One, the, of course, growing relationship between Russia and China, even though I don't think that is a limitless, you know, fully trusted bilateral partnership. I think there are some problems there. But still, I think the fact how, you know, China has responded since in support of Russia, and also that statement, that bilateral partnership statement that came out right before this as well, really showed, I think, the closeness of those two partners, which of course impacts Europe as well. And then secondly, more generally, the kind of, you know, again, the rules-based international system, the fact that a country in Europe was invaded, and that we even saw partners in Asia who, you know, have voted in the United Nations to condemn this. We've seen key Asian partners also join sanctions against Russia. So, you know, this, again, Ukraine is not necessarily just a European issue. It has global and international repercussions for global peace and stability. And in that respect, I think, again, you know, looking at potential future flashpoints, the issue of Taiwan in that respect came up. And there's, you know, consideration for what that means if that does happen. I don't think those two scenarios are identical. There are a lot of differences between those two contingencies. And so you can't draw direct comparisons. And I don't think that that's being done. But what I do think is being done is at least a consideration, a deeper consideration of what that potential flashpoint will mean for, you know, global supply chain resilience, for the global economy more general, for regional stability, and of course also for the rules-based international system. So, you know, it's offered, I think, a reminder that flashpoints don't necessarily stay static forever, and that the unexpected can happen, and that contingencies need to be drawn up and strategic thinking needs to happen as to what a response would be from your own national standpoint.
Well, Virila, thank you so much for providing such great context on these relationships between the UK and China and the UK and Taiwan. You know, I think it's really clear that these are relationships that are very much in flux. They're very much in a period of evolution. And I think you've done a great job of outlining what came before and what could potentially come in the future. You know, I think it's obvious that the political situation in the UK continues to be a bit uncertain, but you've provided such great detail that I think will really help us as we look forward to the future. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief, our frequent public seminars, and our other podcasts. You can also listen to more episodes of this podcast on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.